I am Planta on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Terry Glavin joins me again, the award-winning journalist, has a new book out, Come From the Shadows, A Long and Lonely Struggle for Peace in Afghanistan. It's a thought-provoking read about a place and a conflict we hear about a great deal, but perhaps don't think about nearly as often as we should. In this book, Mr. Glavin looks at Afghanistan and its people, but he also goes there and goes outside the wire, as it were, and shows us a different sort of Afghanistan, where its children are going to school, where women's rights activists are speaking out, where rebuilding is happening. With Canada's role in the region changing and the American government also adjusting its role, even towards reconciliation with the Taliban, Terry Glavin warns us about what could happen. What I found particularly thoughtful was the author's challenge and evisceration of the left's knee-jerk reaction that we should never have been there to begin with, that we should pull out immediately, and that it was never Canada's place to be there. We'll get him to tell us more of what's in the book. Terry Glavin was last on for his book, Waiting for the Macaws. He lectures at the University of Victoria, is the co-founder of the Canada-Afghanistan Solidarity Committee, and he's won many prizes for his work, including the 2009 British Columbia Lieutenant Governor's Award for Literary Excellence. His blog is at transmontanus.blogspot.com. This book is published by Douglas and McIntyre. Please welcome back to the Planta Online program in Victoria, Terry Glavin. Good morning, Mr. Glavin.
Good morning, Douglas.
Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. So you begin the book by talking about this place, Absurdistan, which is, I suppose, how we view Afghanistan if we listen to the popular press or the politicians of the day. Walk us through that, and then we'll talk about the Afghanistan that you've been to, that you've actually seen.
Well, it's not just the politicians and the popular press. If that were the case, it wouldn't be so worrisome. But there is this country that has kind of embedded itself in the Western consciousness, and most noticeably in Canada, which is interesting. It's certainly not, Canada is not unique in this. You'll find it in throughout the Anglosphere. You'll find it in Europe to an extent, but it is most pronounced in Canada. And it's a fictional country. It's a country that doesn't exist. And if you tell that country's story in a way that situates 9-1-1 in the middle of it, what you get is an astonishing work of fiction. And that's the thing that I have that I've tried to look at closely. And if you want, I'll just sort of read you a couple of paragraphs. And this is Absurdistan.
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
After Soviet troops poured into Afghanistan in the late 1970s, the United States opened up a decisive front in the Cold War by arming and training anti-Soviet mujahideen in order to overthrow Afghanistan's communist government and drive out the Russians. U.S. President Ronald Reagan's mujahideen forces were victorious, but they turned on one another in a long and horrific civil war that ended only in 1996 when the Islamic fundamentalist Taliban seized control of the country. At first welcomed by war-weary Afghans, the Taliban soon imposed an oppressive and brutal order derived from a strict interpretation of the Quran. The Taliban ended the anarchy of the warlord years, halted opium production, and tackled corruption, but in a classic case of foreign policy blowback, America's former anti-Soviet allies became America's sworn enemies. Owing to the strict Afghan tribal code of Pashtun Wali, which demands that Afghans protect their guests, the Taliban continued to provide shelter to Osama bin Laden, whose al-Qaeda terrorist network had targeted the United States. In response to the catastrophe of September 11, the White House rallied America's NATO partners to a war on terror coalition that invaded Afghanistan and overthrew the Taliban government. But it wasn't long before the NATO coalition was sinking into a quagmire of Afghan hostility. Resentment of the U.S. occupation soon devolved into defiance of Hamid Karzai's corrupt government and a dramatic upsurge in popular support for the Taliban insurgency. The ambitions of the U.S.-led mission failed to take into account the deeply rooted religious traditions of the Taliban in Afghan culture, and while they are Muslim extremists, the Taliban have no ambitions for global terrorism, and Afghanistan is chronically plagued by insurgencies. Afghan society is conservative and profoundly misogynistic, and Afghans are fiercely independent and quick to take up arms against any foreign intervention. This is why the West has failed in its efforts to impose democracy on Afghanistan at the point of a gun. Now there will be listeners that will notice something a little bit odd about bits and pieces of that, I should hope. But my point is that you could tell that story anywhere. You could tell it in question period in the House of Commons in Ottawa. You could write it in the Toronto Star column or say these things in a lecture at a university. Nobody would blink an eye, really. And the entire story I just told you is a fiction. Every single sentence contains a falsehood. Most of those sentences contain at least one. We could just, if you want, go through that again very, very briefly to give you a sense of what I mean.
People have, as you said, have heard that ad infinitum in the press and the sort, and they don't blink an eye. But so who's responsible then for these misconceptions we have and these distortions?
Very good. That's the question. And I don't think it's really politicians in the popular press, although they have played into this, and it's been a bit of a funhouse mirror effect. But if you do a little bit of archaeology into that narrative landscape, if you like, what I found was actually quite disturbing. You can see it take shape. You can see it take shape and form in the days and weeks immediately following September 11th. And Michael Barrowbay, who is an American academic intellectual and author I have a lot of respect for, he wrote a book. He's kind of like me. We're both of the left. And the way he does the archaeology, he situates it, the origins of this, in the lectures that Noam Chomsky was giving in the weeks after 9/11. And that's where you can say, if you know, every story has to start somewhere, that's where it starts. There are people who have done some deeper archaeology and how it came to pass that such a fiction would have so easily taken root. People like Moshe Postone at the University of Chicago, and in Britain, Nick Cohen, a great journalist, winner of the Orwell Prize, columnist for The Guardian and The Independent. And in Canada, I should say one of the most underappreciated books of recent years, which is Joseph Heath and Andrew Potter's Rebel Cell, Why the Culture Can't Be Jammed.
Yeah.
And also people like Ophelia Benson have looked at the degree to which, by that morning of September 11th, it's hard to imagine any time and any culture that was more ill-equipped to deal with the trauma of that morning. I puzzle this through, and I just say, look, here it is. I don't know. These are people who've got some very interesting evidence-based explanations for this. My own take is similar. I mean, I don't really have, believe it or not, many opinions that I'm trying to express in this book. I'm just saying, here it is. You know, I don't know why I'm the one who has any explaining to do. how did it come to pass, for instance, that wonderful people in the New Democratic Party, members, rank and filers, MPs, how did it come to pass that the official position of the New Democratic Party, peace talks, troops out, peace talks, and then actually some very elaborate and detailed prescriptions about how that would be achieved, who would oversee the peace talks, how they would be conducted, I don't know how else to describe this. Is it pejorative to say plagiarism? But it reads almost like a plagiarism of the Islamist far right's position in Afghanistan, and indeed the position of the crypto-fascist Afghan Mellat Party. Now, I'm just asking the question, how did it come to pass that this purportedly left-wing party in Canada adopted a position on Afghanistan almost unique among all of the serious political parties in the Western world that is a mirror image, is basically exactly the same position as the far right the crypto-fascist and Islamist far right in Afghanistan, and is in direct contradiction and opposition to the position of the Afghan women's rights leadership, Afghan intellectuals, the Afghan liberal left, journalists, academics, socialists, and so on. How did that happen? I'm just asking.
Now, you know, you've identified yourself as a guy from the left, and there's one article about this book where they say that this is a book that the right will like, whether one agrees with that or not, well, that's a question for another time. You talk in the book about the left's reaction, and you've just said that in the last little while. On this issue, did the left leave you? I mean, has the left lost its way, as it will?
Well, I think there's a lot of evidence to suggest that something has happened. And again, I'm not the only one to notice this. I mean, much smarter people than I have been asking this question. You know, maybe a quarter of a century ago, if not more, something has happened. Something is there in the all the places where the left used to be. And I mean, fair play. Take whatever positions you might want to take. Adopt whatever policy and posture you might want to adopt. But I'm just saying, look, spare me your pleadings, right? Don't tell me you're progressive. Don't tell me there's anything left wing or progressive or internationalist about this, because there isn't. There's nothing of the kind there. And I don't know. I mean, it may be that this sort of absolute frenzy over Occupy Wall Street is, I mean, great. I don't want to take anything away from people who have quite legitimate concerns and want to do something about the vast disparities in wealth and the excesses of finance, capitalism, and so on. Please do. But it seems to me that there's something nutty going on here, and in both a kind of an unhealthy and a perfectly healthy way. It may be dying, this phenomenon that I've described, tried to sort of sketch. It may be actually, I mean, dementia sort of precedes brain death, but there may also be something new being born here. The youth that are involved in this, it's very useful, it's very questioning. I mean, you know, you go to a demonstration that's not really a demonstration, it's not really a rally, it's not really a protest, it's more of an assembly, and then everybody has to interrogate one another about what it is we're trying to protest. Exactly. That can't be a bad thing, it seems to me. So that's one thing that I'm a ridiculous optimist. It may be something, you know, that this thing that displaced the left is actually dying. And the other thing I may not have really focused on too much is the way, although this is one thing I focus on, it's the one little opinion that I have about it, is that, you know, it may be a much greater trauma that morning. It may have been much more traumatic. The imagery, I mean, my God, there was nothing like it since Pearl Harbor, and it certainly wasn't Pearl Harbor. There was nothing quite as much of a shock to the system since maybe Kennedy's assassination. But the spectacle of those two huge buildings disappearing into a cloud of smoke and ash, you know, people in times of trauma will retreat into comforting narratives. And that was certainly noticed in the sort of old-fashioned culture in America. You know, people would go to church and they'd sing the anthem and they were very sweet to one another and, you know, home and hearth and community and all that sort of thing. But in the broader popular culture, I think what we haven't paid attention to is the way the counterculture has become the mainstream culture itself. And I think the trauma, that there was significant trauma that occurred in the counterculture, the popular culture. It went berserk, I think. It may have been already a little bit berserk. But we retreated into comforting narratives. This was all about American imperialism. Silly questions like why do they hate us? Well, who's they and who are us? And is this really hatred that we're so we wanted some story. We wanted some pattern. We wanted some mood music. and people like Michael Moore and Cindy Sheehan and Noam Chomsky were there with all the mood music, and there were, you know, sit-ins and anti-war demonstrations. And, you know, in the case, for instance, of the war in Iraq, that can't actually work in Canada as anything more than a kind of a placebo, because we weren't involved in the Iraqi enterprise, really. I mean, we had nothing to do with it, or very little. So something happened. Now, what I'm trying to do is say, look, let's look at the evidence for any of this, and see if there's actually any evidence there. And in order to do that, you have to sort of come out of absurdistan and traverse that dark and weird chasm until you come up the other side in the real country, Afghanistan. And what do you find there? And that's basically what I've done in the book. And I find when I talk about the book, what I've tried to do is I've tried to make room for Afghan voices. Yeah. To introduce the reader to Afghan people, to introduce the reader to Afghan cities and towns.
How many times have you been to Afghanistan?
Four times over the last 2.5 years, I guess.
Yeah, and what have you seen there?
Well, I did go once with the troops. I wanted to know what the experience for Canadian soldiers was like, so I went to Trenton the way a Canadian soldier would, and I flew into Afghanistan in the way a Canadian soldier would. And, you know, spiraled out of the sky in one of those Hercules things and landed in Kandahar airfield and hung out there for a while. But I spent time in Kabul. I spent time in Kandahar briefly by myself outside the wire, which was pretty scary.
Yeah.
In Tutankhar and Charikar, in Mazar-i-Sharif, in Balkh. You know, I just wandered around with a couple of Afghan friends, and a couple. I was very fortunate in having made very good friends with some fairly serious Afghan writers and intellectuals and journalists, who, you know, introduced me to all the big shots and all the leading politicians and that kind of thing. But I was as interested in people on the street and people who are anti-poverty activists, people who are, you know, human rights activists, people who are women's rights activists, parliamentarians, some of them. But there's as many sort of ordinary blokes that show up in my book as big shots.
And we don't see...
And I couldn't find anyone, by the way.
Yeah.
Couldn't find anyone who thought troops out was a good idea. I've never heard of anybody. And nobody's serious. I mean, in Afghanistan, who thinks like that?
So, but are they cognizant of the fact the Afghans of sort of the internal debates that we've had in this country about the mission there?
They are. This is something that is interesting. The ordinary people. I mean, when you get down into the south around Kandahar, they know absolutely nothing about anything. There was a wonderful ICOS poll, formerly the Senless Council, last fall, a very large sample size of Kandahari and Helmandi men, urban and rural, and 9 out of every 10 men knew nothing about September 11th, knew nothing about the planes going into the buildings, nothing like that. And then there's a little anecdote of Sergeant Jeffrey Bullard. He's an American guy, American soldier, was doing some mentoring and troop training and walk-alongs with the Afghan National Army up in Paktia, which is on the border, another sort of Pashtun backwater. And the people there thought the Americans were Russians. They hadn't even heard that the Russians had left. But if you go to most of the cities, Herat, Jalalabad, Kabul, and I would say probably half the population of Afghanistan is either urban or pretty darn close to it now. That country has significantly changed over the years. And by the way, there's something like 300 and something radio stations as well.
Really?
People are tuned in, and particularly in the, you know, the literate sections of the population. Yesterday I went out for coffee with Sanjay Sohail, who's the editor-in-chief of Hashti Sob, which is a liberal daily in Afghanistan. And, you know, when there's demonstrations in Toronto or Washington or London or Vancouver, that makes news in Afghanistan. That's big news. They hear what we say. They listen very closely. Kabbalis and Heratis particularly are acutely aware. They can smell betrayal and abandonment a mile away. And here's how that works. It fuels the corrosion of corruption. Because if the sense of everybody's got is, well, it's going to all end tomorrow anyhow, we might as well get it while the getting's good. And so if you're in, you know, if somebody comes to you in Pragmon and says, well, we want to put a subdivision over here and a road, and by the way, just sign your name on this paper, Mr. District Regional Approval Officer, and we'll set you up in a condo in Dubai. You know, everybody's looking for an exit strategy. What are you going to do? Well, you know, if you're a women's rights leader, if you're a young reformist, a secularist, a Democrat, are you really going to stick your neck out? Are you really going to walk out there in the cool and the dark all by yourself if it could all end tomorrow and the bad guys are back in town? And if you are some savage commander of Gulbuddin Hekmatyar's Hezbi Islami or the Kathashura Taliban or this thing that we imagine to be distinct from it called the Haqqani Network or Lashkar-e-Taiba or Lashkar-e-Jhangvi, you hear this stuff and you go, wow, this puts a smile on my face and a spring in my step. You get all of these people in the rich countries of the world and they're having demonstrations saying troops out. Yeah, way to go. And then Obama comes along and says, all you need to do is hang on until 2014.
Yeah.
So, yeah, my this is the one opinion I have, by the way, is that I, and I say it, and I think I provide evidence to support it, is that it may be that the way we talk about Afghanistan has meant more to the to events as they've unfolded in that country than all the guns and money that we've sent there since 2001. And the way we talk about Afghanistan is determined by the way we think about it. There was a wonderful international poll conducted by the University of Maryland that showed that in those countries where people think that the Afghans don't want us to be there, the public opinion is overwhelmingly that NATO should withdraw. In those places, those countries, among those people who know that that's not true and who know that Afghans actually do want us to be there, the overwhelming majority of them do, the response is, no, we don't want NATO to withdraw. So in Canada, you have this absolute silence, kind of radio silence. This isn't a criticism of the journalists, by the way. One thing I've noticed is that, you know, it just doesn't penetrate. I mean, you know, there's been wonderful reporters who've been there and have tried to tell these stories from outside the wire. Mitch Potter, Rosie DiMano,
Blatchford,
Christy Blatchford, although she spends most of her time with the soldiers, bless her heart. I mean, yeah. I know that's not a criticism. But they just don't seem to penetrate. It's like you can say this stuff, you can provide the evidence, and it doesn't matter. People have got this mood music still running through their heads, and they don't want to know. They just don't want to know. And the difficulty with this book, of course, I don't know why conservatives would particularly like it. I mean, maybe they will. Maybe some will. The conservatives don't come off looking all that good in the book. Liberals don't either. Bob Rae does. The New Democratic Party certainly does not.
No.
But interestingly, the one politician that comes off kind of nice in the book, I think, is Don Black, who was too briefly, the NDP's defense and foreign affairs critic. Mm-hmm. So it's a small town. This is the kind of thing, well, you know, what am I going to do? Am I going to lie to people? Am I going to sugarcoat it? I don't have anything in my piles of notebooks that would allow me to do that. I just have to write it down. This is what happened. These are the facts. This is what I saw. And here's a bunch of stories.
Yeah. So finally, Terry, in moving forward with what the Obama administration wants, with our mission there evolving, are you hopeful?
Well, I'm always hopeful about Afghanistan because, let's lament and let's not kid ourselves. You know, the condition of the people and particularly the women there is pretty miserable. I mean, it's outrageously miserable 10 years in, but that should give you some idea of the astonishing distance that we've traveled or how bad things actually were in that country 10 years ago, where a third of the people were refugees, the people who were remaining were eating rats and grass, half the population was slaves, you know, women were cattle. The Hazaras were being subjected to genocide. It was worse than Europe in 1945, you know, the landscape that was revealed to us on the morning of September 12th, 2001. And the progress has just been staggering. I don't know, I can't think of another period in human history where it's just been this kind of progress up out of depravity and barbarism, working with practically nothing in such a short period of time. So I'm hopeful about Afghans, but I'm not particularly hopeful, I wish I was, about our own culture. By that I mean Western culture, if there is such a thing. By that I mean rich people, because, you know, all of this stuff, we are the 99%. Well, sorry, Wall Street, you're actually the 1% in the world. Once you get out the confines of the borough of Manhattan, you know, and you keep walking, you'll find that actually those protesters are within the 1%, or pretty close. Mm-hmm. And out there, that's the thing to keep your eye on, and I suspect that the this thing, as I say, whatever it is, the pseudo left, the reactionary left, the counterculture left, I don't know how to describe it exactly, or I certainly don't think there's much left wing about it, but never mind. The events of the Arab Spring, the closer you look at this, you know, we've been told for a quarter of a century that Israel is the biggest problem in the Middle East. And suddenly we have a quarter of a billion people rising up, sacrificing their lives in the most astonishing and broad insurrection of a type that we have not seen since 1917. What is it, 1948? Is it 1848? Is it 1968? Nobody knows what this means. Mm-hmm. But I'm hoping that the smarter young people who are involved in, starting to engage politically now, will look back and say, hey, wait a minute. All of these people we've been listening to, all these multi-millionaires like Michael Moore, all these people who complain about never getting in the media, but they're always in the media, like Noam Chomsky and others, they've been lying to us. They've been wrong. So, you never know. Maybe I should be hopeful.
Terry, this is such a fascinating book, a thought-provoking one. Congratulations on it. Good luck with it. I appreciate this interview today.
Thanks very much. Take care, Joseph.
You're very welcome. Transmontanus.blogspot.com is Terry's blog. He's also a regular now, I guess, at the Ottawa Citizen. Come from the Shadows, the Long and Lonely Struggle for Peace in Afghanistan. It's published by Douglas and McIntyre. It's author Terry Glavin on the line from Victoria in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plante.